What in the wild, wild world of the markets is going on here?
This is Jerry Toome with Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome of Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Toome. This is Michael Williams. Well, Jerry, it's been quite the past week or so in the markets. We've seen some pretty big down days. We saw a record up day. Tariffs are on, tariffs are off. What in the world's going on?
It is a mess. I mean, it's completely a mess, which I know Trump kind of likes that to some degree because he loves. I was reading some points. David McCord, our president of our company, market analyst, wrote off or typed off or printed off, rather, what Trump's keys to the art of the deal are. And always think big. Now, Trump, a lot of people don't know, Trump went to church where Norman Vincent Peale for a while, where Norman Vincent Peale taught. And Vincent Peale was one of the progenitors of the positive mental attitude school of thinking. So he grew up thinking that way, or at least was taught that. And he was in some ways, he was kind of a trust fund baby. So he didn't earn this from dollar one. He didn't start at ground zero. But at the same time, he's an amazing negotiator. He's a ramrod. I mean, here we are with, 70 countries are coming to him to try to make a new deal. And I'm like, good grief. So he's postponed the tariffs for 90 days. The big thing that upset the apple cart this week, and I emphasize this week, because we don't know what will happen next week, and it was different than what happened last week, was the bond market went crazy. There's a famous quote from James Carville, who was one of, I was not fond of politically or personally either, but he was one of Clinton's advisors. He was talking about reincarnation. This is sort of a joke, and I don't believe in reincarnation, obviously. But he said, I thought about if I were reincarnated, I would come back as a president or the Pope or 400 baseball hitter. That's what he wanted to come back at. But he said, now I'd like to come back as the bond market. You can intimidate everybody, and that's what happened this week. The bond market went crazy. Most of the time, historically speaking, when stocks go down, bonds go up, just like the proverbial seesaw. So the old buy and hold school of thinking, hey, you put X amount in bonds, you put X amount in stocks. When the stocks go down, the bonds go up, and that kind of helps cushion your equity losses. Right now, it's not working that way. I think at the end of the day, it probably will still work that way. There's some funky things going on somewhere. I'm not 100% sure where it's coming from, and nobody else is either. I've read, you know, some of the hedge funds may be using treasuries and doing some, you know, how last summer we had the Japanese carry trade that blew up, and it was almost overnight. We just had a trap door open, and boom, the market was down. The economy wasn't affected. Nothing really happened. We overcame that and came back. Then, of course, we had the presidential election that happened. And the speculation, which is rampant, there's, you know, multiple theories floating around Wall Street on why the bond market is not acting the way it, quote, ought to. The one that I think makes the most sense right now is leverage coming unwound in one of two sources. It either one firm, I think this was UBS, said that people are selling their bonds to meet the margin calls on their stocks. One of the things that you know is when you have a severe bear market, there's always going to be margin calls, and we'll talk about the market in a moment. So it could be margin call selling, you know, covering your, you know, again, if you have $1 million in stocks and half of that's borrowed, then you've got a huge bill you've got to fill. You got to pay them immediately or they're going to dump your stocks in the afternoon of trading, which is really a whole lot of what caused the 2008 crash to be as bad as it was. So that's one possibility. Another real, I think, it's almost like a game of Clue, you know, a murder mystery. How do you, you know, was it, you know, Mr. Green with the candlestick in the library or what? I don't know exactly yet. Nobody knows right now. because leverage, when it starts coming in wild like that, can just go crazy. And usually you figure it out later. You don't usually, you know, you don't usually figure it out at the time it's going on. Kind of like Warren Buffett's famous quote about, you don't know who's been skinny dipping until the tide goes out. And by the way, Warren Buffett has raised enormous amounts of cash. And I'm not advocating you try to be another Warren Buffett, but I think it's quite interesting that he's got record amounts of cash that he, you know, he basically doubled the amount of money he had in cash last year. He tends to be a value investor. He also tends to be right most of the time, and you can look at his stock. And I'm not advocating buying a stock. That's not a recommendation, but I can say, hey, the guy's pretty wise. Was he 90-something years old? He's probably the number one investor of all time at this point in history. But anyway, so the bond market acted weird. There's other speculation that some of these trades, probably by hedge funds, we don't know, had levered positions 100-1. Holy smokes.
That's unreal.
100-1 lever. So what they were doing is they'll have paired trades. Again, this reminds me of long-term capital management from 1998, which at the time was the largest hedge fund in the world. And it had grown and had two Nobel Prize winners. And they said, we're going to develop this system, and became the largest hedge fund in the world in 4 years, believe it or not. And then blew the entire world up, and they had to intervene. The Fed had to come in and intervene and basically take them out of business, take all their positions over, hand them out to the Wall Street guys to keep from crashing the entire world, because we were headed that direction. And it ended up being a mama bear, only about a 20% bear. Then it bounced. Then it went back down and tested the lows 3 months later. And we're probably going to talk about testing the lows today with this market. So these bears are weird. They have certain behaviors, but the normal behavior is not for the bond market to be tanking at the stock market at the tanking at the same time. So my smeller, if you will, if I'm a detective, I'm walking around with my magnifying glass looking for clues. I think something really big's going on with leverage. That by itself, I don't believe will stop the I would not say this is a bull market anymore. I don't think it'll stop the economy in its tracks. The trade deficits and trade issues have the potential to do that. We know the worst of that's been postponed. So apparently 70 countries are coming to negotiate. We're going to talk with Vanita Dimitrova of Ned Davis in the second half of the show, an interview we did last week, which is slightly dated, but not really. The same principles are still true. So we got a third of the debt rolling over from the U.S. government this year, the national debt, the $36 trillion wonderful debt that President Trump and Elon are trying to get rid of, or not get rid of, but reduce the rate of growth on that. So one possible good thing is, if we end up in a recession, if we end up in a real bear market, interest rates virtually always have fallen in that cycle. Right now, they're not falling. That's the weird thing about this thing. I still think at the end of the day, though, if we end up seeing a recession, if we end up with this becoming a big bear market, not a little bear market, not a mama bear, if this ends up being a daddy bear, which it very well could by the end of this year, or probably not into next year, I'm guessing by the end of this year, it'd probably be over fairly quickly, then the downside, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow on that thing, will be the fact that you're looking at renegotiating. David McCorder, president of a company, market analyst, said about a third of the U.S. debt, $36 trillion, rolls over this year to be renewed. Meaning, if you don't know how that works, when you buy a treasury bond or treasury bill or whatever, you're loaning your money to the government. They're paying you an interest on it. Our credit rating has gone from AAA to AA, according to most of the analysts out there, most of the rating agencies. But we have to keep rolling that debt continuously. Rolling debt gathers no loss, kind of thing, you know. So we keep rolling that down the road. We keep having bigger debt. That's part of what DOGE is trying to cut. That's what part of what Trump is trying to attack. They're saying this is an existential threat if it keeps compounding at this kind of rate. That's what basically both of them believe. Now, they're not really sort of saying that, but they sort of are. But the bottom line, that's why, you know, Trump loves to have everything being uncertain, but he doesn't want chaos to spring out, and he cannot afford to lose the midterm elections. And if he has a recession and a bear, that's very high probability he will. Normally, the party in power loses the midterms anyway. So he has a razor-thin majority as we stand now. That's very dangerous for his life, almost, because I think you know, impeachment could be brought back up. I mean, there's all that kind of stuff. So bottom line is bonds are not acting the way they're normally doing it, but we think there's some hokey pokey going on with leverage most likely causing this. The stock market, of course, hit its low. The question is, what type of bear is this? So if you haven't read the newsletter that we just put out, that I just put out, called Bear Market Starting, which at the end of March, I put a question mark behind that because it's like, I think this is the bear market that's starting. Well, 2 weeks later, it's no longer question mark. Now, it, to me, is a bear market. Now, keep in mind that there are, and Michael, you know this real well because you helped me put an investment course together back in the 2000s. And we taught on this very thing in a course we taught called Facts and Fallacies. And that is two things. Number one, Wall Street always identifies a bear market in stocks as a 20% drop in the S&P 500. Whoever invented that? We have no clue. It's been around the market for decades, at least the last time, all the time I've been in this industry since 1980. And it's sort of arbitrary. I thought it was quite a coincidence. So I was looking at some material a moment ago about what happened in Trump's previous administration. And at the very end, tail end of his administration, the Federal Reserve was being stubborn and not lowering interest rates like they needed to, and they were too tight on their money, and they nearly created a bear market. How far did the S&P go down? 19.8%. What a coincidence! Only it's not a bear. It went down 19.8. I'm like, oh, come on, people. We're, in my view, and you don't have to share this view, but in my view, we are clearly entering a bear market. We've clearly entered it. It's kind of like, okay, the best easy way to do that, and all of you out there can do this if you want to, is use a simple moving average, 200-day moving average. I think we talked about it last week. The 200-day moving average, what happens is it's the best and easiest way to me, and it's nothing's infallible in our industry, but essentially you're looking for something that divides the bulls from the bears. And so when you get in a bull market, occasionally it'll dip below the 200-day moving average and kind of freak people out for a few days, and that's kind of normal. But the analogy, if I want to use that of a pool, of a swimming pool, let's say you're in a, let's say you're going to be in the Olympics, or let's say you've got your outdoor pool. If you take your foot and you kind of drag it across the surface and you disturb the water a little bit, that's what happens in a bull market. You barely dip below the 200-day moving average. Shortly, everybody starts to freak out because usually they've come out of a bear and now we're back in a new bull and they're like, oh no, is it going to happen again? And they're freaking out. And it turns around because the economy was not going into recession at that point. It was just a short-term correction that got overdone, usually because somebody had too much leverage. Leverage kills if you have too much of it. Think about the long-term capital management guys that blew up the world in 1998. Largest hedge fund in the world at the time. 4 years. Two Nobel Prize winners put it together using modern portfolio theory, which clearly I don't agree with and don't believe in. As a matter of fact, you typically bash it. And oh, by the way, one famous guy I know named Warren Buffett also makes fun of it, and he laughs. He said when his partner Charlie Munger was alive, he said, Charlie and I should endow these chairs to teach these theories. And he was laughing about it. He said, that makes it our job a whole lot easier because it says markets are always efficient, and I can't go in that today. We don't have enough time because we got an interview coming in the second half of the show. But one of the fallacies I thought that the Wall Street's going to, I don't know, you be the judge and see if you have ever heard this before. By the way, Warren Buffett went from $189 billion in cash in the quarter one of last year to $334 billion in cash at the end of 24. He says, of course, well, there's no significance at all. Well, yeah, right. And he always plays his cards close to his chest. He doesn't. He likes to keep people in suspense. And, of course, he's really running businesses more than individual stock portfolio. He buys whole businesses, which nobody else can do. But anyway, here's the facts and fallacies that we talked about many times in the past, but it hasn't been pertinent till, again, right now. All right, so see if you've ever heard this from anybody connected to Wall Street, and I will not name any names here. If you took the 10 worst days in the market and you subtracted those your rate of return, let's say the S&P, this one doesn't have all the numbers, but it's like typically you'll see, well, the S&P was 12% a year, 15% a year. It depends on when you do the study, you know, what the results are going to be. You can slice and dice it in multiple ways. But the argument, again, is the key is you have to not, they don't talk about avoiding the big down days. They talk about you moving your money out of the market and missing the big up days. That's the whole thesis. And they slice and dice this statistically, and I always say, you know, figures don't lie, but liars know how to you know what. The bottom line, and I'm not calling people in our industry a liar. I'm saying this is a fallacy that we've talked about for decades that you're going to hear, and they're going to trot it out again this time, almost certainly. What were the 10 best days? Let's take the whole last century, going back as far as we can to 1928. So you're almost 100 years of data here. One day, if you'd missed out on the first day of March 15th of 1933, you missed a 16.61% return. The next biggest day since 1928, 12.5, 12.3, 11, 11, 11, 11, 10, 10, 10, and 9. Now, those dates...
Which are great. I mean, you'd love to be in days where your portfolio is up 10% in one day.
We sort of had one similar to that just a couple of last week.
But right? There's a little bit of context.
There's it. Yes, context is really important. Let's see. Two of those days where you had the biggest one-day up day was October 13th of, drumroll please, 2008. What was going on in 2008? In October, on October of 2008, you were in a massive crash, the worst bear market of our lifetime.
Great financial crisis.
It was, and it threatened the whole world system. The seventh best day was October 28th of 2008, when you had a 10.79% gain. Now, this is, again, this sourced, it's called The Scarecrow and the 10 Best Days Rule, and this article is written by Brandon Langley, and it's updated September 15th of 2024. That was the most recent data I could find that has done this study for that long a period of time. That's
so,
just 6 months
old. So it
didn't
have this week's bounce?
No, it didn't.
Although
have that
it would qualify.
It would fit right in there. Okay, so here's the rest of the dates. March of 1933, October of 29, October of 31, September of 39.
Sure, a lot of these in the 30s.
30s, yeah. What happened in the 30s? I don't know. Seemed like the scratch my head. Or it seemed like something happened in the 30s economically and stock market-wise. Also, September 1939, September of 1932, two in 2008, 1931, 2020. Oh, there's a new date, 2020, the ninth best day on the S&P since 1928 was in 2020, which, of course, we know that was COVID. Mm-hmm. Was that in the middle of a bear market?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so 1935. What is the common denominator of all these best days? That you're supposedly, if you ever get out of the market, you'll miss the best days.
They're in downturns.
They're in massive bear markets, the daddy bear markets that we talk about.
Which makes sense emotionally because people get overly negative,
right?
And so it oversells.
But too much in, yeah.
And so they,
especially with leverage.
We, as a group of humans, we tend to go too much either way.
Yeah.
When the market's going up, we take it too high and it has to come correct. If we're going down, we're way too fearful and it goes way too far and
right.
It's got to bounce back.
The selling gets too heavy.
And so we're just talking about that bounce back.
The bounce back. So, but it's a fallacy, in my opinion, to say I'm going to go back over the last 100 days or 30 years or 100 years or 30 years or whatever, and somehow surgically extract those big monster bounces, which all occurred in bear markets. Oh, well, you have, what, I think 326 trading days on the average year. Some leap years are different.
Right.
But 326 days, and if you miss the one best day in who knows whatever period of time you want to talk about, that what that means is you sold the day before and you bought back the next day. And your returns are grossly lowered by missing that one bounce. The fallacy behind that, again, and this is something that irritates the heck out of me, as you know, because you're a stats major and you know we've talked about this many times in the past. The issue is, how likely is it that you sold the day before the bottom and then bought back after one of the 10 best days. And the context is completely wrong, because the context is all of these are happening in massive crashes.
Well, if you
daddy bear, bear markets.
Even if you just look at this recent one.
Right.
You know, Wednesday we had that great pop, even made David McCord make a weird noise during our meeting. It was kind of funny. But last week we had two big down days that were larger than the up day. And so you're actually, you bounced. We like that because you want to come back from what you lost from, but you're still not back up. You're still down compared to last week.
Yeah, financially you're down. So Buffett raising cash, that'll be a clue. The 10 best days. By the way, if you go back and do the research, and again, I've got to make this very quick for lack of time, but the bottom line is the 10 best days typically are the other side of that story is the 10 worst days. So in other words, if you miss out on the 10 worst days, that helps you, and those typically happen at different times. So the bottom line is it's a fallacy to say you surgically somehow extract the worst days in the history of the market and how much that makes your return go down over the long run. That's long-term buy and hold thinking, which I clearly do not agree with. So anyhow, in the most recent recessions, earnings have crashed 18%, 40%, and 21% respectively. That's 2000, 2008, and 2020. If earnings go down significantly, I think we're headed for a recession. I don't see how we avoid one with the tariff problems. And there's more. It's always like Warren Buffett said.
You're still thinking mild?
Do what?
You still thinking mild on the recession?
Right now, potentially a mild recession, unless we get into real war with Iran, which very much could happen. If we don't get into a war with Iran, it's probably it might be a mild recession. But it's the longer this drags on, all this crap that's happening in the market, the more likely it becomes more than a mild recession.
Sure.
And then it's a daddy bear bear market at that point. But the bottom line is earnings until now have been fine. Unemployment has been fine to this point. That all changes starting now. And so anyway, those things have happened. I think it's a disservice to people to emphasize missing the 10 worst days when if you looked at historically the 10 best days, because if you looked at it, if you had the 10 worst and the 10 best days, you come out best. And we ran through that very hurriedly because it's a fallacy of modern day thinking with portfolios. Bottom line is NASDAQ is 10.8% below the 200-day moving average. Again, that to me is the best demarcation of bear and bull. And when that moving average moves over, because you throw out the oldest data, you put in the new data, you recalculate the average, when the moving average itself rolls over, that is almost always a sign that you're in a bear market. So there's three psychological phases. I'll run through this very quick. The denial phase that we're in a bear, which is where I think we are today. So we're not officially in a bear until S&P's down 20%. The reality is that's when we hit what's called the recognition phase, which psychologically is, okay, now we are recognizing we're in a bear, but we're not sure what to do about it. That's when most people, the first part, they're in denial. The second part is usually a deer in the headlights. I don't know what to do. The final phase, if this is a bigger bear, which is where I think we're headed, is called the capitulation phase. That's where everybody throws in the towel. The market goes through the floor, creates a great buying opportunity for the next cycle. But I think that's what we're seeing right now, and I think it's going to happen this year. If you haven't read the new special report that happened right before all this chaos started, bear market starting, it's on our website, cornerstonereport.com.
All right, well, we'd like to take just a small break here to remind you how you can learn more about Cornerstone Financial Services. Jerry Tuma, myself, Micah Williams, our president, Dave McCord, and our team at Cornerstone Financial by going to cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. That's also where you can find Jerry's latest special report, Bear Market Starting. Again, like you mentioned, it came out just before all this chaos started. So it's a good one to read, why we thought the bear market was starting even before it actually became the bear market. So again, you can find that at cornerstonereport.com. You can listen to our previous week's broadcast, some interviews we've done through the year. We pull those out separate for you so you can listen to them. Again, just at cornerstonereport.com. You can also find our show and our podcast found on Apple, Spotify, and Amazon Audible. Just look for Jerry Tuma's Smart Money. So again, for our podcast, just look for Jerry Tuma's Smart Money. Typically, you just type in Jerry Tuma, and it will pull up for you. And if you'd like a free consultation, please give us a call at 1-800-327-4285. That's 1-800-327-4285. 327-4285. Well, Jerry, we got a very interesting interview with Vanetta Dimitrova of Ned Davis Research. And again, if anybody would like to learn more about Ned Davis Research, you can find them at NDR.com. So NDR for Ned Davis Research.com.
Ned Davis is one of the old timers from Technical Analysis School. He's not a buy and hold thinker. They have models. They have a bunch of different models. So I can't, you know, I can almost not keep up with all of them. But a lot of the charts that you're seeing, if you read Bear Market Starting, are from his service. Matter of fact, from Ned's writing himself. He still writes from time to time, even though I love his first, you know, his most important book. It's called Being Right or Making Money. And it deals with emotions and the marketplace. Vanetta is one of the economists. She's the global economist for them. And we discussed here, what we discussed was the impact of the tariffs and what they would have. And, of course, this is before we knew, before Trump blinked, basically.
Before the pause.
Yeah, he said, oh, wait a minute, we're just going to do a 10% tariff across the board except for China. And that was before that happened and renegotiated. And that sounds like, oh, whew. You know, you look at the art of the deal, he always goes big. He always going to, if you're trying to buy a $1 billion hotel, he's going to bid too high, or he's going to, you know, ask for too much, or he's going to lowball if he's trying to buy. That's just his way of doing things.
Yeah, if you want to figure out what he's thinking, that's a good, go find, we just did an AI summary of the book again to remind us, and man, it's just like, wow, this is his playbook.
This is what he's doing right now, and he's just doing, I saw a picture on Facebook that I thought, of course it was a fake picture, but it showed Xi Jinping sitting there reading The Art of the Deal. And I'm like, well, right. I hope somebody in his administration did, sort of. But the bottom line is that he's doing his thing the way he does it.
And the tariffs haven't gone away, so this is still important information.
And this, we don't know where it's going to settle.
We don't know where
it's going to settle. We won't know that probably till July would be my guess. And I know he's wanting bilateral deals with individual countries for the most part. And of course, the EU will probably be in total. But the bottom line is he's going to get the best deal he can. And the challenge is it's upsetting the apple cart in terms of uncertainty. I've read horror stories about multinational companies or smaller companies. Their supply chains are spread out all over the world. How's that going to affect you? You have a 25% in Canada tariff. How does that affect me? Blah, 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 blah. It's going to be inflationary in the short run. It's going to be deflationary in the long run because it will reduce the consumer spending. And in this case, it looks like it will hurt the lowest income module people the worst in this. So I do believe we're headed for a recession. If you look at our newsletter, Bear Market Starting, the Challenger Survey, which is announcements that they're going to have essentially layoffs, but they haven't pulled them yet. That's coming. So I think by the third quarter, we're in a recession for sure. The question is it going to be a daddy bear or a mama bear? And the answer is yet to be determined. And watch out for Iran.
All right, well, let's go to the interview with Vanetta Dimitrova of Ned Davis Research.
And Vanetta, the U.S. President Trump sent shockwaves through the stock market last week with his announcement on the tariffs. Your associate, Alejandra Grindel, in her April 3rd newsletter said, shocking tariffs to derail the economy. And that sounds pretty interesting to me. If the tariffs stay intact, and I know he's going to negotiate, they're very likely to push the economy into a recession. That's what her conclusion was. That sounds right to me. But my question to you is, you have an opinion as well. First of all, do you agree with this assessment? Would you like to elaborate further on what kind of damage this could do or will do to the global economy if everybody sticks to their guns?
Well, yeah, the first salvo here of this trade war came from President Trump, right? So it's only natural to expect that some of the larger economies that have the propensity to retaliate will do so. And as the trade war escalates, it will necessarily hit the U.S. economy as well from abroad. The U.S. itself will suffer damage from the tariffs here. But your question was about the global economy here and Alejandro's assessment, which I very much agree with, right? I mean, we've been riding on this train here of increased economic policy uncertainty, mainly from the U.S. And the expectation was that the announcement of reciprocal tariffs would relieve at least some of that policy uncertainty and will give some reprieve to markets here, right? Nothing like that happened. Quite the opposite. The announcement of the tariffs was for much larger taxes than previously expected, much larger tariffs than previously expected, and on a broad swath of countries that some, you know, could never even figure into, you know, economic thinking when you think about developed economies here. But the general understanding really became that because of the way the tariffs were structured, with a very rigid formula designed by the White House, and the relief of those tariffs was left basically to President Trump to assess, there isn't much room here for negotiation. They were designed with the prime purpose of eliminating the trade deficit, the bilateral trade deficit, I should say, of the U.S. with individual countries, and you know, will necessarily hurt both the U.S. and, you know, our trading partners. Some of the assessments out there from the International Monetary Fund, for example, are that a 10% increase in U.S. tariffs will result in a half a percentage point decline in global growth. And because the average tariff that was announced by President Trump is more than double that, the expectation is, based on economic theory, that you know, the hit on the global economy will be around a percentage point or more. And Alejandro's assessment, with which I fully agree here, is that if this really were to materialize, and it runs on the assumption that those announced tariffs will remain in place for a while, then the global economy will really suffer significant damage here. Prior to the announcement of these tariffs, our projection was for the global economy to expand at a 3.1% rate this year. And if you go down by a full percentage point from that, it will put you below the 2.5% mark for global growth, which historically has been the delineation for a global recession. And this is how you jump from a currently well-positioned economy to one that veers toward recession in globally, really. And then if you want to talk about the U.S. economy, it will also suffer significant damage. I mean, this is quite a disruptive policy that is instituted in a very, quick way. There isn't a rollout, sequential increase, or announcement of tariffs. It's just a broad-based blanket, very high and much higher than anticipated tariffs on the rest of the world. And the adjustment of the U.S. economy to this new reality necessarily results in, you know, some damage to growth, as well as higher prices, especially in the near term. So even though the damage from tariffs to the U.S. may seem that it will be small, given that the size of our exports to the rest of the world is just like 10-11% of GDP, while other countries have much greater shares of exports to GDP, we will not go unscathed. And this repricing, if you will, of new economic realities, what's been, weighing on markets, not just in the past two days since announcing the reciprocal tariffs, but for a couple of weeks now in anticipation of what we're seeing.
Okay. So your assessment agrees with Alejandra that it looks like global recession. I know you mentioned in your April 4th piece, you stated the U.S. job market is in good shape before the tariff war. I know unemployment's been climbing slowly, but it looks to you like we're also going to suffer damage if Trump does not back down.
Yeah. It will sure move in that direction. And there are several aspects through which the tariff war will impact, or I should say, we expect that it will impact the labor market and the broader economy. Since your question is specifically about the labor market here and the March employment report, what it shows truly is that the labor market is still in a relatively good shape. But as those tariffs come into place and they hit both final and intermediate goods, the cost of production and the cost of doing business in the U.S. will increase. And as that hits corporate earnings and is factored into earnings expectations down the road, this is when the rubber meets the road, really, right? So if your business plan is designed for a different cost structure and all of a sudden you have 25 to 50% higher costs, what is the first response for a business to do here? Looking at average costs and marginal costs of doing business, the first thing to do is look at your variable costs and adjust those. And labor is the largest one of those. So as your other costs increase, as a business, you could either reduce hours worked or employers that are in your staffing. And this is where, you know, the hit on employment will come first, mostly from businesses who could not shift directly to substitute to inputs that can be sourced from a cheaper source or domestically. And, you know, if this turns out to be a, negative effect that feeds on itself, this is how you get a full-blown recession. Instead of talking about a sectoral impact, because tariffs are so broad-based on everything from everywhere, it will be very easy to get the negative snowball effect.
That sounds exactly right, and that's what I see coming too, but I don't have the expertise quite that you do on the macroeconomics, but at the same time, this sounds correct to me. Now, let's talk about some specifics. A larger global economy like China and Europe, they're likely to fight back against Trump's tariffs. Smaller economies, I don't know, Mexico, Canada, I haven't heard the latest, might knuckle under. Can you comment a little bit on this perspective? The big guys versus the little guys, how is that going to play out? And what do you see happening with other economies around the world, especially places like South Korea, other parts of Asia?
That's a big question, right? I mean, all these economies are very diverse economies with very different structures and exposures to the U.S. market. China is a special case, right? Not just because we have a large merchandising trade deficit with them, but also because they already know what it feels like to face large tariffs. The 2018-19 tariffs that President Trump imposed at the time sort of prepared them, if you will, for an even larger, you know, shock, if you want to call it now, to them. Although given that they already have the experience, it's probably less of a shock, you could argue. So they have been preparing for this moment, for the eventual maybe return of Trump to the White House, which materialized, and he's following through on the promises that he's made in terms of tariffs. So what China is doing, it's already retaliating. Even with the first, prior to the announcement of the reciprocal tariffs, it had already announced some retaliation to the initial 20% increase in tariffs that the president had put on imports from China. But, you know, it also, raised tariffs on all U.S. Exports to China by 34% today, right? So it's already retaliating. It has the capacity to do so. The smaller economies, like many in Southeast Asia who have very large export dependency to the U.S., are not so lucky, right? So, but China can definitely benefit from this moment here. And given the geographic proximity to countries like Vietnam and even South Korea, they could align, those smaller economies could align better with China than they are aligned with the U.S. right now. Right, and this is one of the downsides to a policy, trade policy, international trade policy that is not well thought of. So in this case, China has the potential to retaliate, and it could even, like I said, bring closer relations with countries that have no other option but take it on the chin, if you will, from the hit on their goods from our tariffs, right?
Yeah.
Mexico and Canada, they're a special case too because of the USMCA, and that agreement is still very much in place. So all goods that are, you know, USMCA compliant are still zero tariffed. The rest, is subject to higher tariffs, but the majority of trade with those two countries is not. The agreement itself will be renegotiated and we will see how it's going to play out, but my expectation is that, you know, we will have a continuation of this agreement because of the large economic benefits we have seen over time. You could harp on the topic that a lot of manufacturing jobs have moved to Mexico, but there's also benefits from trade between between our three countries here in North America. In Europe, goes the same way, similar to China, because of the size. We also have a very large deficit with the European Union, and they do have the propensity to respond with retaliation. More than that, they have the capacity to stimulate the domestic economy. And we already saw with the large stimulus bill that was passed in Germany for, you know, stimulating both defense and infrastructure spending in the continent, that, you know, they're willing to do that spending. So that will kind of mitigate the negative impact on the continent from the tariffs that U.S. is doing. China is also stimulating their economy, and we know that, you know, it's very difficult for them to do that. They don't want to fall into a debt trap, if you will. But if China were to align with local economies better, one of the benefits for China is that it will have a source to countries with better demographic outlook than its own. That has been one of the negatives for the long-term outlook for China.
Okay.
And if because of trade, China aligns better with the regional economies in Asia and gives it access to their demographics and labor force, then it will benefit from that as well. So this is in addition to the positive fiscal stimulus that China is implementing into the country. And, you know, it's one of the unforeseen, perhaps, impacts of this global trade realignment.
That's an excellent point. I hadn't thought that through, but that's very good. And it gives them better demographics, obviously, from the China's one-child policy. Let's go back to the United States for a second. One of the biggest, and this could be U.S., it also could apply and will apply, I'm sure, internationally. One of the biggest negatives to me, from my perspective, corporations could slam shut like a clam on future CapEx, at least for a while. Looks like it's, as we've been talking about, looks like it's pushing us into a recession. Do you see the corporate executives slamming their purses shut? And if so, for how long?
This is everywhere in the CapEx surveys that we track. All the regional manufacturing surveys are showing exactly what you're describing, that there is this cyclical, you know, delay in CapEx plans. I don't want to call them shut down just yet, but because of this grand policy uncertainty that I mentioned in the beginning, many executives are skittish on investing, especially for the long term, right? Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that in regional manufacturing surveys, in the surveys of big businesses like CEO and CFO, confidence businesses, even the Small Business Optimism Index from the NFIB also shows some uncertainty there. So yeah, CapEx is being held back precisely because of not knowing how long those tariffs are going to stay in place. And right after the reciprocal tariffs were announced, Treasury Secretary Bessent had a very interesting interview with Bloomberg, I believe it was, and he mentioned there explicitly that the tariffs that were mentioned are basically a cap, assuming that there is no retaliation. And from here on out, the door is basically open to renegotiate more favorable terms with the baseline of 10% kept in mind as a tariff for all imports. But 10% is much less than 65%, right? Yeah. So this in itself, as favorable as it may sound for the future, for the countries that may renegotiate terms, is actually negative when it comes to economic policy and trade policy uncertainty. Not knowing what trade policy will look like 6 months from now is probably what's keeping businesses from investing or moving, if you will, even some of their factories here. Yes, the president is announcing grand plans from large corporations to reshore production. And a lot of that is going on even before the tariffs, right? I mean, I'm sure businesses learned, you know, a valuable lesson during COVID that having very concentrated supply chains and relying just on just-in-time inventories could come to bite you, right? So reshoring some production or friendshoring or nearshoring probably would have continued with or without the tariffs. To bring everything back to the U.S., though, is a tall order, especially in the near term. And this is where the economy may hit some obstacles, right? I mean, it's for the long term to have greater manufacturing capacity and to have a reindustrialized nation that produces a lot of the high value manufacturing output in the country will be great. This is the long term goal of the administration, supposedly. But hitting all countries and all goods imports with tariffs, including on, you know, small consumer goods like toys and apparel and things like that, that are, you know, produced at a much lower cost and at a lower cost producer country, may not play too well. Right. I mean, we don't have the labor force at the time, and we probably don't have the, you know, the comparative advantage, if you will, relative to those low cost countries to produce the same output at the same price. So, you know, when it comes to producing everything domestically, there are pluses and minuses here, right? Mm-hmm. And the blanket level of these reciprocal tariffs seem to have kind of ignored the theory of comparative advantage and are simply aiming to eliminate the trade deficit. The grander point here when it comes to the trade deficit and current account overall deficit elimination, the bigger point is that it comes alongside a financial services surplus. So you lose the current account deficit, let's say, but you also lose the financial account surplus. And the financial account surplus consists of foreign direct investment, as well as portfolio investment, which is the bigger share of it, actually. It's much bigger than foreign direct investment. So our economy has been, you know, lucky enough to be large enough, open enough, very liquid capital markets, rule of law. All of these things have been attracting foreign investors. And the dollars that had gone abroad for things that we do not produce domestically have come back to the country in the form of investment, stimulating, you know, CapEx. Without the current account deficit, you know, portfolio investment will probably decline first, but overall smaller foreign investment will reduce the demand for financial instruments, including treasuries, and this is where some of the balances may start to unravel.
Yeah, this is quite complicated, but it's excellent information. Which economies do you think will be most negatively impacted? Is that really apparent at this point, or is it too soon to tell?
It's too soon to tell for one main reason, that we don't know just yet how long the tariffs will stay in place. Perhaps there will be sufficient backlash that they will be, you know, altered in some way. But even if we stay at the baseline tariff of 10%, there will be some countries who will be hit more than other countries, right? I mean, like I said earlier, those with a greater export dependence to the U.S. Will probably suffer more. Those who have greater alternatives to the U.S. to export their goods or have a greater capacity to stimulate their own domestic demand, and these are larger economies, will probably fare a little bit better. But Southeast Asia, let's say, where a lot of the consumer goods are imported from in the U.S., will face quite a bit of difficulty, I would assume.
Yeah, I would assume so, too. Well, I appreciate that. This has been very enlightening, and it's very technical, but at the same time, this is what we're dealing with. We've got a very unusual situation with a president who seems to be very determined, even though, like you said, Bessent may have softened it a little bit on his recent interview. This is still a wild and woolly world to me from what I'm seeing, and I'm not sure we're through with all the shocks that are going to hit the system, not necessarily only pertaining to tariffs. But excellent information, and we want to have you back on our show again at some point in the near future.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, I hope you found that interview very informative. It's a lot to absorb, Jerry, but it's very good information.
It was excellent information. I actually listened to that interview three times in my car driving around just to make sure I got all of Vanetta's points. And they're extremely good. The bottom line is that we're still very unsettled in this whole thing. We don't know where the tariffs are going to land. I do believe that none of them are going to be positive. So I understand President Trump's thinking. He's saying, hey, we've been taken advantage of for who knows how long. I don't know how far back the tariffs go. And people have been putting tariffs on our products, and we've not put tariffs on their products. And it's misaligned, the way the global trade ought to be. I remember him saying in his first administration, somewhere around 2018 or thereabouts, he said, okay, you want free trade? We'll have free trade. Everybody has nor tariffs. Nobody has tariffs. We won't have tariffs if nobody else has tariffs. So he's taking, I don't say advantage of it, he's trying to right what I believe is a wrong that's been going on for at least 40 years, as long as I've been in the industry. And the problem is it's not going to be easy to go through. It reminds me of remodeling a home. You got to tear a whole bunch of stuff down. It really makes a mess in the short run. But in the long run, he's trying to do the best thing for the country. I hope that he's right on his timing. The Ned Davis interview, Ned Davis, what is it, NDR.com?
NDR.com.
That's where you get their information, and they're an institutional research firm, extremely good. Again, his first book, or his premier book, Being Right or Making Money, by Ned Davis.
All right, thank you very much, and we'll see you next week.
Jerry Tuma Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone can help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.